Hello, and welcome to the Architects of Destination Advocacy podcast from Destinations International, the international trade association representing destination organizations. This podcast has been exclusively produced by Relic Agency. I'm Andreas Weisenborn, joined with Jack Johnson of Destinations International. Today, we are proud to welcome you to our inaugural podcast on a title we both share in part or in full, Advocacy. For this series, we want to tell the story of usual and somewhat unusual suspects in our sector's history and key advocacy moments for them. We intend for these stories to tell the tale in full, containing both joy and triumph or crisis and disappointment. Each month, we will be joined by a guest to tell their role in a key moment in their destination's history. These are your architects of destination advocacy. So for this month's episode and our first, we wanted to spend some time at the beginning of why this topic of advocacy is so important to us and how we see entities who engage in destination promotion. So let me set it up and ask first. Jack, you are the de facto advocacy czar around these parts. What does the word and responsibility mean to you?
Advocacy is kind of such a general term, which is probably why everyone uses it and why it has trouble with the definition. Advocacy, you're merely arguing on behalf of someone or something. You're making the case. When I was a kid and decided I wanted to be in politics, my goal was to be the attorney general because they were the advocate for the people of the state I was in. So that was a very appealing quality. The part that sticks out in my title, though, is chief. I'm not the chief lobbyist of the industry. I'm the chief advocacy officer, which kind of puts a lot of responsibility on me and you and everyone else that's part of the team, that we're kind of to be the experts. We are to be the knowledgeable folks. But more importantly, we've got a proven history and we're good at it, which means we have to teach it and we have to apply it over and over and over, depending what the situations are. I take it personal because I see us as advocates of the industry, destination organizations very specifically, not the whole travel industry. And that's a lot and something I actually enjoy doing. How about you?
Now I'll jump in. So I share the title in part with you. So the other half is research. I've always sort of educated people on, I feel like when you say research, people have a pretty clear understanding of what research is. They think back to their childhood. I always reference the Muffets and Beaker. He would, take core samples, this type of stuff. People understand research, but I think advocacy, that is never a title originally ever sought or ever thought that I would obtain. And I never really saw it prior to coming to Destinations International. I've always sort of learned from you in the sector around us is how it's articulated as basically a person, place, or thing who's really willing to defend, articulate, put forth a set of beliefs, ideas, or ideologies in what we believe in. I agree with you. It is something that I think it is not just a skill set that should be kept within, but something that we try to do our best to teach others to be. In reality, advocacy is for everyone. And I think part of our responsibility sort of looking at it is that we teach that anyone can essentially be more or less an advocate.
Actually, when I hired you, I knew you wanted to be the research person. I was like, can this guy be the advocacy person? That was the only hesitancy I had. And then I was going to wonder when I slipped advocacy to the front of your title, if you're going to actually say anything about that.
It's funny because now I want to give up research and just be advocacy. Here we are. It is worth pointing out for us and for the listeners of this, we are recording this in March 2021. I think it's worth, Jack and I just kind of talking about the landscape of stuff that we see it as. You and I have, been here before the pandemic and we are still in the pandemic and the landscape we've seen. I thought it'd be kind of point just to talk about just sort of where we are in our timeline as it relates to destination organizations. And I think we each kind of have a sort of viewpoint at what we think hopefully comes next and sort of where we are. So, Jack, I'll put it to you first.
What comes next is the rebound. Oh, I'm actually pretty excited about that. What I've said for the last year is that the pandemic is not just a tragic thing that has happened, but it's also an opportunity. That's the political side of me speaking. You never want to let an opportunity, a good crisis, go to waste. It's a good opportunity. And by that, I meant, in 2019, we pushed out the community shared value concept. And in all honesty, I thought it would take 4 to 10 years for the industry really to totally pivot, embrace that, and actually change the way they operate. The fact that they would think about the residents as their primary customer, but also think about their residents as they do everything, whether they're branding, marketing, whatever. They're always in the back of your head, and they're always part of the equation when you make a decision. With the pandemic, it is. I said in a blog just the other day, we're now in this period of the great acceleration. What would have taken 4 to 10 years could be done in 1 to 2 years. The focus on the residents, the focus on the community has been not only a wise policy, but it's just been a survival technique for most of our destinations. So that's the first thing. Second thing is the infrastructure is still there. We lost hundreds of thousands of businesses, but it's not like those restaurants turned into something else. The restaurants are still there. The bars are still there. So the comeback actually is, I think, very well positioned. That plus the fact that there's like $1.3 trillion, I think I said, saw in the New York Times the other day, in new savings that money people haven't spent during the pandemic that can fuel this. Because we all know that travel's in our DNA. It's always done this. If you look at the last two crises, 9/11 and that recession, the Great Recession, we came back stronger than ever before. People are passionate about what we talk about. So I'm proud that's going to come back. The other thing is that the rebound, I think, is going to be incredibly strong. Not only is the infrastructure all there still, the restaurants are still there. They may have closed, but they're still there. Bars and attractions and such. So reopening and rebuilding can be done quickly. And the last piece is I had feared that the pandemic and the closures and the slowing down and everyone sheltering in place would actually just take a wrecking ball to everyone's revenues, particularly at the local and state or province level. And what we're seeing is numbers are actually stronger than we thought they would be. March, April, May of last year were bad, but since then they have rebounded. And then with the passage, at least in the United States, of the latest relief package, which has a $350 billion in it for state and local governments, I actually think the big threat that our budgets would be cut so they could move money elsewhere is actually lessening. And I think a lot of local governments actually see that we drive tax revenue or now, and actually we've positioned ourselves pretty good. And we've been a community shared value because we've helped the people in the community throughout this whole past year.
Yeah, and that's one point. No, it's the right answer. That's the one of the points I wanted to point out. You and I always believed and talked about desertizations are just uniquely qualified entities in the common good realm. It was just about getting the lane cleared. You know, before this, I mean, when we were still living in illogical times, you know, when we're battling against perception and sometimes unwelcome legislation and narrative and that type of stuff, when this sort of happened, being the pandemic and this massive interruption, it just reshuffled the whole deck. And I think you and I sort of saw that this is kind of the opportunity desertizations could capitalize on and uniquely pivot towards to be seen what we've been saying for, like you thought, you know, would take a decade or more, can be compressed and being a community shared value, you know, especially the topic of economic growth out of this, you know, because everyone is sort of looking, saying, well, how do we actually rebound in this and how do we actually reconfigure our economic engines? And there is no conversation with economic recovery that doesn't include destination promotion and tourism, which we in our sector are uniquely qualified to do. You know, we are absolutely part of that conversation, that waves to get us out of this.
We're not just uniquely qualified. We are actually took the biggest hit. So unless the travel industry comes back, there is no recovery. And that's just plain and simple.
Correct. That's a great next segment.
But I think people will see going forward that the brand of the destination is probably the most important thing they have. And that's right in the wheelhouse of every destination organization.
Absolutely. So, as we said earlier, for each month, we want to interview a guest and their tale of advocacy and the role it played in a very pivotal moment in their destination. So for this particular episode, our first, I'm humbled to interview the man sitting next to me virtually, Jack Johnson himself. But not Jack as you know him today. Today, we're actually going to talk to Jack from 2015, at his time as our Chief Administrative Officer at Choose Chicago, and the night the funding ran out. So Jack, let's set the stage here. Talk me through how you and Choose Chicago saw the community and the organization at your time in Chicago before the incident we're going to get to later.
When I first started, it was actually the Chicago Convention and Tourism Bureau. I was there for 7 years. I had previously worked for the Convention Center, McCormick Place, which also operated Navy Pier in Chicago, the number one tourism attraction. So I had knowledge of that, and I wasn't a stranger when I walked in the door there. It was a great opportunity, actually. As I showed up there, like I said, people knew me, and we had a very small organization. I had a budget of like $14.1 million. That was less money than Indianapolis had. We had a very split organization. Tourism, leisure tourism was being handled by a city organization. McCormick Place was probably the sole focus of the Convention Bureau, with a little bit of time and effort put into international tourism. They hired me mid-session. We had three bills that were pending in Springfield, one to create the incentive fund, which would allow them to offer incentives to draw shows to McCormick Place. A second was a total refinancing of the McCormick Place because their bonds were the revenue supporting their bonds were underperforming because of the Great Recession. And an attempt to get $3 million extra for very specific projects. Because we were so unknown, the $3 million was dead in the water. One of the first things I did was set up a meeting with the Speaker of the House, and I did a phone call with him first. And I came back to my boss, who was Tim Robey at the moment, and gave him the lay of the land. And I basically said, good news is that he knows what the Chicago Convention and Tourism Bureau is. The bad news is he doesn't know how it's different from the McPeer Authority. The good news that he knows about you. The bad news is he thinks you are your predecessor. He doesn't exactly, he remembers giving extra special money to the Convention Bureau, but he has no reason why or who had asked for it. And that was really the extent of his knowledge. So by the time I took Tim in to see the Speaker, I'd already briefed the Speaker totally on it. So he actually knew about us going into that meeting. And that's probably the first thing, the first time that we actually started broadcasting who we were. The community didn't really know anything about us. We didn't, like I said, our focus was externally selling McCormick Place, and we did very little locally. So there was a lot of building to be done.
So walk us through this. So at the 30,000 foot view, what actually happened that was so pivotal to your career? And then when did you originally just get, you know, you got basically wind of something was about to happen?
All right. Brief history of what happened before Milwaukee and no one knowing us. And by the time we got to the 40% cut crisis, McCormick Place was on a unstable financial footing. So we actually had to totally refinance McCormick Place, reshape McCormick Place. So in that legislation, we were able to turn what basically was a bloated government bureaucracy into a property management firm. And with the reforms that we were able to get in labor, we put it on a competitive footing with Vegas and Orlando. And part of that, I also got new funding sources for the Chicago Convention and Tourism Bureau. And I forced them and the Convention Bureau, the Convention Authority to work together, because the money flowed through the Convention Authority but could only be spent on us. So we basically had to start working together. The incentive fund was included in all that. So we actually had funds to spend. We had incentive money to throw at clients, and that working relation really started. During that whole period, we built out the first advocacy plan we had. And because there was so much to do with McCormick Place, passing that legislation, and then all the things it really needed to do in the next year or two after that, we developed a very leadership-focused strategy. Because Illinois is such a leader-focused, they all have such power, that if the idea is if you can get the mayor of Chicago, the Speaker of the House, the President of the Senate, and the governor behind you, you know, you can get anything passed. And that's somewhat true. My problem was I didn't have the governor behind me. So I actually brought in the minority leader from the House and the more minority leader in the Senate. And we built out basically a veto-proof margin. So when the governor vetoed our legislation, which he did twice, we were able to override it each time. He stopped vetoing our legislation, so that problem kind of went away. From there, we started moving forward. We always had a legislative agenda. Mayor Rahm Emanuel came in. He raised the hotel tax, again, a crisis that we were able to leverage as an opportunity. in exchange for, you know, taking one for the team. And I always say, don't take one for the team. You can take one for the team only if you get something really good for it. And what we got was the merger of the Chicago Office of Tourism with the Chicago Convention of Tourism, and then another funding source within the city to help us out going forward. And that's when we got the $5 million from the airport. That actually also put us in the middle of the city's economic development strategy. So at this point, we're really raising our profile. Don Welch had come in to become CEO.
And what year was that when Don came in?
So I was there 2 years when he came in. So 15 minus 5, 2000. So it was really exciting times, really footing times. We were actually raising our profile. We were going after big events. We took the James Beard Awards from Chicago, excuse me, from New York. We took the NFL draft out of New York. I always like to say that Don Welch created the modern NFL draft. That turned out to be a huge event for us. So we actually were becoming an incredibly public event. He also changed our legislative strategy. Why we've always focused on the leadership. There's a flaw with the leadership strategy, which is if any one of them gets hit by a car, you've just lost that big chunk of it. So over all this time, we were actually building the grassroots army. So we were expanding our membership by offering a basic membership at $99, and we were collecting the names of these people. We're collecting email addresses. We're getting Twitter addresses. We set up a whole website, built the advocacy. We set up what we call the first responders, which were the people that we would tweet out to whenever there was a crisis. We got in the habit of having them send letters. We could click our fingers and send the message out. And literally within 24 hours, we would develop several thousand letters. So we actually built a very strong organization. And we coupled that with a very strong community outreach. So we were also in the neighborhoods doing stuff. We were in all the local chambers of commerce we were connecting with, all the aldermen we were connecting with. I spent a lot of time just meeting, explaining who we were, making connections. So we actually were in an ideal political position. And then the election came and our former chair, Bruce Rauner, was elected governor. And I still had close relationships with all four legislative leaders, including the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate. So we actually were incredibly well-positioned. We had dreams of, you know, enacting the final pieces of my legacy, which would reshape the whole funding system in Illinois. And that's when the bottom fell out.
I think what makes the story so impressive is, you know, formerly also working at a destination organization and also hearing this story from you and others from Choose who came to Destination International, is that we always looked up to Chicago, right? There's only so many cities like that in the world. And from us and other smaller ones, well, it's like, well, you know, that's Choose, that's Chicago. And to hear you tell what happens next, I think just puts so many shockwaves across the sector because we're like, well, crap, if that could happen to Choose, what does that mean for us? What does that happen for the rest of us? So, yeah, that's what's true about it. So walk us through actually what did happen as part of it. So you were on this monumental rise. And like you said, the final building blocks to what you wanted your advocacy legacy to be there. And then what happened? When did the bottom fall out?
I did have a pretty good legacy going into that. And I think you're right. We actually started capturing up the attention of the industry, which was kind of flattering. So when this happened, it was like, to me, it was like incredibly embarrassing. And even when I talk about how it ended, I've always got to put an asterisk on it and explain why the ending is actually really, really good.
Well, I mean, there's part of the story that's, I think it's interesting getting to know you is that it's not just like you had a bad day at your job one day. This is actually intrinsically personal to you. Why was it so personal to you?
I always say politics isn't personal, it's business, and the way you operate it is that way. But for me, everything was always personal. I treated the money as if it was my money and took care of it. All those employees that had been hired because we were able to enlarge the budget, I took personal responsibility for because they were there because of what I did, but they were also could go away if that anyone ever happened. And we were doing some really, really good stuff. I mean, we really were. And the Chicago tourism numbers were going through the roof. So there's that responsibility to the city and just to keep that going. And there's kind of a inferiority complex, maybe, if you come from Chicago. Particularly if you come from the South Side, like I do. And that just kind of egged us on. The fact that we were making such huge strides was like, okay, we're in the big leagues finally. When I first found out we were probably in a problem situation was when actually after Bruce had been inaugurated and we got a call from the governor's office of budget, and they were making preliminary cuts in the current budget, hoping to improve the situation for them to introduce a new budget, which would happen 6 months later. They asked us to hold back money in our accounts, which were held by the state. And I, again, wrote a blog about this also, which was around early January. When it came my turn to respond, I said, you know, I love Bruce. We all love Bruce. Anything we can do to help Bruce be a successful governor, we're there. But my understanding is the money you're talking about is actually locally levied. And while you do control the fund, it's actually local money. So you don't have any authority over it. So we'll agree to hold that money if you can get me the proper legal authority telling me that that's legal for you to do. In other words, I said no. And the person I was saying no to is a good friend of mine and a person who I respect. And I guarantee you, if she'd been in my shoes, she would have done the same thing. We got the call 2 days later that we weren't going to actually have to hold the money and the money would continue to flow to us. But that's when Don was on a trip at the time. So Don comes back to that. And then I had the pleasure. I was like, welcome back. By the way, I think we're in trouble.
And how did he answer?
No, we're not. Don is a sunny and he's optimistic. And like you said, we had the governor, we had the speaker, we had the president of the Senate, the House Minority Leader, Senate Minority Leader, the mayor, as crazy it is to working for Rahm Emanuel, he was behind us 100%. So he's like, no, you're kidding me. No, listen, we're going to be okay. You're just overreacting. And, you know, I do tend to be the glass half full guy to his glass, he's the glass half full guy and I'm the glass half empty guy. Between the two of us, we got one glass. So it was just, he just kind of blew it up. He just thought I was just being overly cautious. When we saw the budget negotiations that were going on just for the state budget as a whole, it was very clear that the House Democrats and the Senate Democrats were going to pass a budget that was what they thought government should be doing, and we didn't have the revenues to do that. But they didn't put a tax increase. They didn't pass a tax increase. They were going to hand it off to Governor Rauner with the intent for him either to line item veto the heck out of it in order to bring it back in balance. And that really would have meant cutting probably 30 to 40% of that budget out. Or he would come to the table and negotiate some sort of revenue increase. That was an ugly situation. And I figured he was going to do line item cuts to bring the budget down. And then we probably would have a standoff. So I was expecting budget cuts. So I figured they would do like 25% across the board or something. And that's what I went back to Don's office again and warned him. I think the situation's getting really toxic down there. And this is what I think they're going to happen. And I believed it so much that I actually had a 2 week vacation plan to go to Napa and up the coast of Northern California and into Oregon, which I reduced to just a long weekend because I was certain this was going to blow up and it was not going to be pretty.
So let me ask you this, and just for the listeners to know, where you walk into Don Welsh's office, I'm referring to, who's the current president and CEO of Destination International, formerly of Choose. You lay this on him. He tells you, Jack, I can't see it happening, that type of stuff. What is your immediate sort of fight or flight response to this?
At that point, I'm in mode to fight. When I took that first call from the Bureau of the Budget, my first reaction was, you know, a big lump in my stomach. When I was on vacation in Napa, that's when my lobbyist called me and said, the governor just vetoed the whole budget. So we weren't going to get a 20, 25% cut. 40% of our budget was gone like that instantly. And there's no standoff. So then I'm like in some small town in Sonoma, California, and I have to call Don. It's like, Don, they vetoed the budget. That means we have no money. And that's somehow when it resonated with him. There wasn't anything I could do, so I just drank wine for another 2 days and then I came home. But literally, when the lobbyist called me, my first reaction, same thing, you know, it's like a kick to the stomach. I felt betrayed. But most of all, I felt stupid for not seeing this coming sooner. I really should have, because the way Bruce ran his campaign, his number one priority as much as he talked about investing in infrastructure and economic development and education and tourism promotion, his number one issue, and I know this just from knowing him personally, is that he hates public sector unions. And he was going to do everything in his power to bring an end to the control that he saw public unions having. And going to the point that he was going to veto the state budget, put a line in the sand and said, give me what I want on unions and we'll talk about everything else. There's no increase in revenue. There's no state budget unless you give me what I need to kill the public unions. He was basically taking the approach of how you cure cancer. He's going to bring Illinois to the brakes of death and then bring it back, which meant that all of us weren't in for an ugly month or two of delayed expenditures. This was going to drag on and on and on and on. So we came back and we just laid out a strategy, including going to Don saying, give me $10,000. I forget whether it was $5,000 or $10,000 to buy an even better grassroots tool than the one I had, to which he said yes right away.
Well, that's a great point to kind of sort of articulate. You obviously, you said these moments of kicking yourself. What did you feel after that was like, okay, this is my immediate battle plan. Like, this is who I know I need to contact. This is who I need. I need to sort of get as allies and coalesce and sort of tactics that we need to implement, immediately, more or less.
Yeah. I mean, what was unusual about this battle, you got to keep this in mind, is this is being fought between my allies. Okay. This is a battle between the Speaker of the House and the President and Senate, who are my allies, who actually put their political future on the line on some of the legislation they passed for us. And on the other side is Bruce Rauner, the governor, who is my former chair, who helped us get into the inner circle of the Rahm Emanuel administration as part of their economic development strategy and introduced us to this whole segment of people in the civic community, the business community that we never would have had access to before. So he was our ally too. So I'm in the middle of a fight between two of our allies, and it's a fight not about me. So it's not like I can win this argument because I'm not even in the argument. So I went back and I remember going to Don's office saying, this is what I want to do. And the basic plan was, we're going to attack them all. I want to improve my grassroots. We're going to go back to that membership base. We're going to get our first responders up and going. And literally what we're going to do for the next however long it takes is pummel these guys with letters and letters and letters to start with. And we're very careful not to blame either one of them, but all of them. And I must admit, I was worried about the attack because we were also letting the press know that we were doing this. And we tried to generate as much public policy. We were also out there trying to expand and activate our reach even farther through the normal people like the Hotel Association, the Restaurant Association, but we were going to the building owners folks who behind us, we were going, some of my best folks were connections we'd made in the realtor community, and they were sending our stuff out. And by the time we were done, we were literally generating 5,000 letters with each batch that we pushed out. And it was great. And then, like I said, we had a separate strategy of just reaching out and meeting as many of these officials as we could talk to find out what the heck was going on.
I think what sort of makes you unique, and I've pointed this out to you before, was that as most of us in the sector who come from sales and marketing backgrounds, that's not you, and there is no, like I said, there is no existing blueprint on like how my funding's cut, how do I return it? What do you think as part of your background, particularly politically, made you so well equipped to handle the crisis, to weather it, to some extent? Like you said, Don flatly told you, I don't believe it. And you had to be the person like, no, I've more or less seen this before. This is what's going to happen. And you were right.
I used to work for the Illinois House of Representatives. So I know how the system works. I've been involved in politics since I was 11, 12, actually, when I first was in front of a grocery store handing out flyers for a candidate. I knew how the system worked. I knew the players. I knew them personally. I look at them differently because I'm looking at them as potential allies or potential foes. So I'm like looking them up and down. That is a big part of it. The lesson I learned early on, though, is that when you're in politics or in this arena, the number one thing is not to be liked. It's to be respected. And rolling over and saying, okay, you guys fight it out, please, when you're done, make sure we get our money. They might like you, but the one person they're going to respect is the guy who screams bloody murder and launches this campaign against them. We actually, like I said, I was a little worried we were a little too harsh too soon. So I sent someone who had connections within the governor's office and said, go in and just feel them out, see what the reaction is. And he came back and said, they said, well played. So it's like, yes, okay. We hit the mark.
What do you feel was sort of like the turning point where you felt, okay, the efforts we enacted, hopefully the battles we won in this, what do you feel was the turning point where like we can come out of this and come out of it better, hopefully?
All those efforts I just talked about actually didn't win the battle. It put us in position to win the battle. We are now one of the entities that might get their money passed in supplemental legislation. So what they were doing during this whole time period was approving little chunks of the budget. So you got to make the bond payments. So they, you know, approve the bond payments. You know, you need to pay the corrections officers. So they pass the corrections budget. Little pieces of that. So what we did was elevate ourselves to be included as part of something that's necessary. So we were in that discussion. The second thing, though, that actually really, I would say, won the battle was going back to what I had done before, which is build this bipartisan coalition in the House and Senate. In Illinois, Cook County is highly Democratic. It's where the power brokers from the Democratic Party come from. It's literally that. A few of the other towns around the state, the Republicans have the bulk of the suburbs, not all, and downstate in southern Illinois. Their Republicans are pretty much based out of DuPage County, which is just west of Chicago, very populous, very corporate headquarters. So me and the DuPage Convention and Visitor Bureau, the two of us basically went to every legislator, Republican legislator we could get to in the collar areas and all the leadership people and met with them one-on-one. This was Don's idea, was to put together this giant binder, which I thought this is going to overwhelm them, but I would sit down with every legislator in Chicago also. So we're doing Dems and Republicans, trying to make this bipartisan again, being an issue that shouldn't be caught up in this partisan fight. But I would flip them through this long, you know, 50 pages of charts and stuff like that. I wouldn't even stop to really talk about any of the charts in person, but I said, your big takeaway and what I'm showing you now, I'm going to leave this with you so you can look at it in detail. But look at every trend line and everything I'm showing you. Ever since this budget halted, it's going down. It was tax collections, it was economics. And then we did a prediction based on how many employees, how many jobs were going to be lost because of this impasse. So we finally got the Republicans and the Dems to say, okay, we will support this. But they were both saying, if the other one puts it on the table. And literally, it took me a month to get someone to make the final decision and put it on the table. And once it was on the table, the House Dems did it. Republicans immediately accepted. And we had worked Rauner, and he had the Republicans deliver the message to him was, we have no budget. We have nothing to bring back to our districts. This is not general revenue funds. This is hotel tax. We have to bring something back to our district while this fight goes on, so we don't look like we've stopped all government. And this was something because there was a convention and visitor bureau in just about every part of Illinois. We were able to bring that back. And so they needed it. So it was needed by Republicans as well as the Democrats. So we finally got it through. It took one final piece of splash, which was we decided to do something old school, which is we ran ads in black and white and red lettering. So it looked really dramatic and scary. But we ran ads in Chicago papers, Rockford papers, Springfield papers, a couple other towns throughout the state, which isn't a way to really sway a lot. But what we did is get a ton of free publicity from the press because we talked about the ads we were running. And anyone who had any one of those newspapers who had the story, who had the ad, did a story on the ad. And then every television person would follow them and do a story on it. And that kind of last bit of like, you are crushing Illinois jobs, was like the final piece we needed to get to have the Democrats put it on the table finally.
I think what makes the story so fascinating is starting to work for you, you know, in early 2017 and having worked with you through the community shared value, the cornerstone, the lexicon, everything about what we believe in, you know, our fundamental ideology, I can see the protoform of this, how this started at your time and choose in particular, you know, that what we've been putting out as our roles at the trade association actually came out of a moment of strife for you in particular. You know, I just think that's something so interesting and worthwhile to point out was that you, in a sense, before you even got to here at Destination International, were probably battle tested to the greatest extent of your life right before, you know, you left. And I think that's what I wanted to sort of talk about was, you know, looking upon it, back upon it now, you mentioned briefly just about, I wish I saw this coming. Do you think there are other signs or, you know, waves or something like that? Did you wish you caught sooner or thought, okay, man, if I did this again, I would have got that faster or something like that?
I mean, I would have started as soon as the election was over and started carving this out as a public need, elevating it to the where we did what we did. I mean, at the end of the day, what popped this out was you are stopping something that every legislator needs to bring back to show their constituents because it's important and it's useful and it's needed. And then we were getting the press to buy into the line, and we were getting, like I said, thousands and thousands of letters. We actually expanded the letter campaign statewide and partnered with all the 40 other convention and visitor bureaus in the state. And really, once you start applying the statewide pressure and you've got people, community, asking for this restoration, we got to the point where they just couldn't say no anymore. Someone had to bring it to an end.
You know, you and others, ultimately, you came to Destination National in 2016. But, you know, from your perspective, what do you think was the ultimate outcome of this crisis and choose?
Again, we were respected. One of the nice things that I heard about after I left is that not only did they get their money the following year, but they got it for 2 years or something like that. And they have been funded through this whole thing. I mean, it took us 5 months to get the money back. It's worth noting that they didn't actually come to a budget agreement for 2 years. So the University of Illinois didn't get their money for 2 years. So anytime that I can beat the University of Illinois like that, you know, I'm damn good.
I like how we're comparing common goods.
But no, I think CHU's very well positioned, and they're a member of that community.
No, I think that's a great point to sort of end on was that, you know, the expression, like you always hopefully leave it better than you found it, but you literally sort of left the organization, you know, at some point it could have potentially went either way, but you left this pathway of advocacy and sort of a pathway to kind of crawl away out of it. And that they've kind of essentially been better off since then. And you've also laid the groundwork for other desertizations saying, here's the signs that I saw, what happened to us. Here's how, you know, if you're facing a similar scenario, what you should look out for and what to sort of, you know, peck apart is where you can sort of fight against more or less, not flight.
Yeah. So it's also why I always warn our members to be wary of brand new governors who come from the business sector as opposed to coming up in the political world.
Yeah. No, great point. So I think that's a great point to sort of jump off. Jack, I want to thank you again. I just want to clarify, you are my first guest, but you will be with us in every one after this. But I thought it was a unique opportunity to actually ask you the story of CHU's, because I don't believe anyone has actually gotten the chance to ask you this. You, as you indicated, you left essentially at the beginning of 2016 to join Destination International. Myself included are very thankful for that since, one, you got to hire me. But I think it was actually a great chance to actually talk about this story, especially since all the work we've gone through, since so much of it came out of this, you know, really key moment in your life. So I just want to thank you for sharing that.
Ah, this was fun. Can't wait to switch hats and interview someone else, though. Thanks, buddy.
All righty. Thank you again for joining myself, Andreas Weiseborn, and Jack Johnson of this month's episode of The Architects of Destination Advocacy. Please make sure to subscribe to the podcast so make sure you always catch our latest episode. To learn more about the work we do, please make sure to subscribe to our newsletter at destinationsinternational.org or by checking our content through the advocacy section at our website or, of course, hearing us speak at one of our upcoming events. Thank you, and we'll talk soon.